listening to Right On Radio on KFAA 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Sam. On tonight's program, Liz talks with Brian O'Hara about his short story collection, Surrender. In bittersweet stories with surprising humor, the characters grapple with the choices they've made in a country they no longer understand. Written in spare and an unsentimental prose, yet with a startling emotional punch, these stories and the unforgettable characters who tell them will live long in their reader's imagination.
And in the last part of the hour, we'll be featuring one of our legacy interviews. Join us as we do a deep dive into the archive and listen to an interview from the past selected by yours truly. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Liz.
Hello.
Hello, Liz.
You're both
Welcome
on the air.
On radio.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled.
It's going to be good. Good, good, good. Are you in L.A.?
I am in L.A., yes.
You want to talk about it? It's 10 below here.
Yeah, you
okay.
know what? Go ahead. I was saying my house has no heat, so it's cold.
Oh, it's not cold. Okay, well, we're talking to Brian O'Hare, author of the book Surrender, and we'd like to start out with a reading from you, if we may.
Absolutely. And real quick, a little context, because I couldn't read anything in its entirety. This is a story called Exiled. And basically, you're going to hear is that the antagonist, Mad Mike, who's the Marine Corps battalion commander, who's like the lord of the manor, or you know, in charge of you know the fiefdom, is gone out into the middle of the desert during the Persian Gulf War to relieve the protagonist, Francis Keene, who's a lieutenant, of his command. And Mad Mike might be drunk, so that's the lead-in.
Okay, so and by the way, I don't think we. Told you, you can't use curse words, so you have to bleep those out as you're reading.
No, that's okay. I happened to find a couple paragraphs with no curse words. Lots of curse words in the book, though. I like curse words. Okay, but I understand the FCC doesn't. So here I go. Mad Mike leans into Keene, his attention feral, almost carnal, under different circumstances, a prelude to a kiss, possibly. But there will be no kiss. Warily, Keene waits for the punchline as Mad Mike lets out a long, slow belch, turning to smile at Corporal Lowe, then back at Keene. The tang of booze lingers stubbornly in the slurry of Mad Mike's breath. Wild turkey and warm coke, the specialty of the house, courtesy, no doubt, of the free market capitalists running the AT&T tent back at Manifa. That is what I think of you and your old man. Mad Mike attempts to reholster his pistol. After several tries, he gives up. The pistol becomes a burden, more dead weight to bear. Keene dares a look at Mad Mike, a cut shorter, 20 years older, and 1,000 beers heavier. Oddly, perhaps, given his immediate peril, Francis registers Mad Mike's cheeks, pitted like pricks from an ice pick, leftovers from an unimaginable adolescence, burning pink now from the booze. Almost like blush. Odder still, their color reminds Keene of the bougainvillea growing in Norma's yard, his girlfriend back in Honolulu, and her ability to extract suffering from him like venom sucked from a snake bite. Her hands, the hands of an artist, possess a kind of magic to create, to cure, to heal. And in that moment, Keene realizes that he hasn't been touched by Norma or any human in more than a year. And deep within Mad Mike, a seed takes root of failure, of defeat, not in the mundane realm of, quote, winners and losers, all just football scores, really, ultimately meaningless, but a personal failing in the realization this failing was a chain, thousands of years long, that bound him, made him a prisoner, and that he willingly pledged himself to this chain out of fear, like a fatal flaw. Yet, for Mad Mike, there was only one way out, and that was forward. Give me your bars and get in the back of the vehicle, Lieutenant, now. Surely this order is rooted in an ingrained faith in the established order of things, the trappings of a rational society, a place where citizens stop at stop signs, say please and thank you, and all Marines, well-trained, respect small pieces of metal on an officer's collar, denoting status and rank. It's also a place where personal mythologies, when alchemized with tribal beliefs, transform fallible human beings, the most common of men, into demigods and lords to be feared, the heroes of sports, war, and politics, the Mad Mikes, slave princes of conquest all. This is no longer that place. Keen remains silent. He's felt it too, this shift, this lifting of the veil. And despite his still considerable fear, he smiles with directness and simplicity, acknowledging for a brief moment their shared intimacy. Mad Mike waves the pistol impatiently, as if swatting an annoying bug. Let's go, Lieutenant. And even as he does it, it feels otherworldly, unbelievable, as if someone else, someone much braver and reckless, is doing it. Keen, dizzy with fear, slaps the .45 from Mad Mike's hand, ejecting the round from the chamber and the magazine from the grip. He launches the magazine into the wind, watching in disbelief as it sails off. Mad Mike's right eye twitches, just barely. It might just be TMJ, the migraine aftershocks, whatever, but it's done, irretrievable. Still in disbelief, Keen presents the weapon to Mad Mike, almost whispering, muzzle discipline, sir. Even as it plays out in front of them, no one will remember what happened, or if indeed it did happen, so unthinkable the total collapse of 200 years of dogma and unimaginable heresy. Some things are best forgotten. There is no return. Mad Mike at least understands that. He steps back from Keen, hawks a defiant stream of Kodiak into the dirt, and announces into the darkening air, I don't have time to hold your hand, Lieutenant. I got a war to win, a nation to liberate, bad guys to punish. Get that vehicle back to battalion ASAP. Mad Mike wheels on his boot and beelines for the Humvee, barking at Lowe, saddle up. Lowe refolds his body back into the cramped vehicle as Mad Mike stares straight ahead, and the Humvee jars awake, does a slow U-turn, and disappears into the orange rind twilight, back to the war and the glory. Keen watches the Humvee melt away, its uncertain diesel growing fainter until, finally, all is silent again. He turns to his Marines, and they regard one another as if from opposite shores, across a great gulf, in terms of rank, certainly, but also in terms of race and even class. But they understand something about each other, indefinable, something that cannot be put into mere words or even spoken aloud, something ancient. They will live within one another always. War is inevitable, without end. You choose your sides. There are no guarantees. There will always be another Mad Mike. And like the Marine Corps itself, Mad Mike is as immortal as the snow-globed desert dust now surrounding them. So while the night wind snakes across the dusty floor, Keen eyeballs the oil drums, just dark shapes now, and spits. That's it.
Brian O'Hare, reading from Surrender, a book of short stories. Let's start with the, you were in the Marine Corps for 6 years during the 91 Gulf War. And I'm wondering how your experiences there informed the short stories in the book, the ones especially about the Gulf War.
I mean, they're a huge part of, you know, what this book is about. I have to say, though, too, the thing that really sort of, you know, this is like the birth of this book was my father, who was a Marine pilot in Vietnam, flew 307 missions, was like the coolest guy in the world. I mean, he was like a cross between like Jackie Gleason and like spaghetti Western era, like Clint Eastwood, you know, this sort of silver tongued New York Irishman. You know, but he died in 1998 from Agent Orange related prostate cancer at age 56. And you know, he had sort of raised me to be a certain kind of American man, I think, you know, this sort of like quintessential idea or ideal of American masculinity, you know, like the football team captain, you know, the not only the football team captain, but, you know, the one, you know, who was the team captain of the team that was like in the USA Today, top 25, you know, all conference. From there, I went to the Naval Academy, you know, and from there, the only path after that was to become a Marine officer, you know, experienced combat for, you know, just long enough, like 4 minutes to have checked that box, you know, became a father. And when my father died, you know, I was 32, and I really started asking, so what does this all mean? What did that all mean? And what was it worth? And so, you know, the title refers to surrendering, you know, a kind of mythology that we all have. You know, that just happened to be the mythology that I had, you know, but we all possess, you know, personal mythologies, familial mythologies, tribal, you know, national. And I got to say, too, that the Marine Corps is a great setting for this sort of laboratory to explain this stuff, because, you know, I would say that their knowledge of their mythology rivals that of, you know, the world's great religions, and they know it. And, you know, the thing that the Marine Corps does better than all the other services, which are great at what they do, is that the Marine Corps passes on its mythology or passes on its culture better than the other services. I mean, right now, I've been out of the Marine Corps for 30 years, but according to that mythology, I'm still a Marine. I'm just not on active duty. And that's some really powerful stuff. So, you know, to your question about what was, you know, the Persian Gulf War experience, it was a huge part of the meat of this book, shall we say, or creating the philosophy of it. But it really goes back to this mythology that for me started, you know, essentially at birth, in the way that my father, again, who was a Marine pilot himself and possessed considerable mythology, he, you know, he hooked his mythology onto that of the Marine Corps, and I was impossible to resist that. So this is sort of me kind of unlearning all of that.
Now, you decided on short stories for this. I'm curious, what about that particular format appealed to you, and how did you pick the short stories, and what order, how you decided on all of that stuff about short stories?
Gotcha. Well, you know, I have to say that, you know, two of my, you know, my ultimate, you know, writer influences, you know, spirit animals, whatever you want to call it, is like Tim O'Brien, who wrote The Things That They Carried, and Phil Klei, the National Book Award winner and Marine, who wrote Redeployment, I think in 2012. And so I think that the short story, you know, is uniquely suited to telling stories about the military and masculinity for whatever reason. Maybe they just did it in such an amazing way that they made it clear to me. I would say the less sexy version of that story is that, you know, 6 years ago or so, when I finally said, look, I need to sit down and just, you know, I've got stories in my head and I need to start putting them down on paper. I almost started out writing these short stories as like backstory or homework for a novel idea that I had. And, you know, and then this sort of like organic world sort of sprung out of it. Characters, you know, had relationships with each other in conversations. And there was a, you know, a 50 something year through line of all these characters. And so I started to think of things as more of a unified whole. Then I like to think that, you know, like those two books, these interconnected short stories read almost sort of like a short novel in a way. And then I would say the ultimately unsexy answer to that question is, I figured if I couldn't write a compelling 15-page story, there was no way that I'd be able to write a compelling 250-page story. So it was practical, too. And it just happened to work out.
I'm curious, you said a little bit about why you went into the military. What would you say about being in the military to young people today who are thinking about it?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, as I like to cheekily say, you know, people ask like, well, how'd you go from being a Marine to being a writer and a filmmaker? And I like to say that, you know, hey, I got some bad career advice, obviously. But I have to say that particularly in a culture like America, this relatively young culture where, you know, we're very cut off from traditions, from, you know, tribal rituals, shall we say, that the military provides a kind of connection that automatically goes back, you know, over 200 years. And you have like ancestor worship, you have, you know, initiation ceremonies, again, rituals, traditions, which is really, I think, particularly appealing for American kids, shall we say. The thing that the Marine Corps sells really that I think is most appealing for people and for me too, is that it sells transformation. And I don't think that the usage of that word is like, it's not coincidental. I mean, again, it's back to this comparison, like with religion. And it takes very common, you know, average American men and women, and it transforms them into like demigods in a way, which I think is very appealing for a lot of people, myself included. I wanted to be transformed basically into my father. So that was, you know, the best way to do that for me was to become a Marine. I mean, I will have to say that beyond all of that, I think what the greatest appeal or the greatest benefit, if I could use like such a crass word, was that it was the first time real. So I'm from a middle-class white suburb of Pittsburgh originally. My first true experience with true diversity happened in the military, first at the Naval Academy. The Navy, even in the 80s when I was in there, was they were trying and they were doing a pretty decent job of sourcing kids that came from a variety of different backgrounds. And then certainly like my PhD in, you know, diversity in a way, and it happened in the Marine Corps. I mean, the U.S. military in a lot of ways is arguably the most diverse tribe in the history of humanity. I mean, everybody is in the U.S. military, and I would say that the really cool thing, or the like unintended byproduct, because that's certainly not why, it's certainly not why the U.S. military was created, but I think people kind of come to an understanding and an appreciation of each other as human beings, rather than these like kind of surface things that divide us, melanin content, who you sleep with or don't sleep with, you know, who you pray to or don't pray to, what sex you are. And you kind of get stripped down through a common suffering, for lack of a better way of putting it, where you get to sort of like appreciate each other as human beings. And for me, as much as I didn't enjoy the Marine Corps and I did not enjoy the Naval Academy, it was a transformational experience for me. I mean, the beginning of the book is dedicated to a handful of my Marines. And it's basically, you know, because you transform the way that I see the world. And that's very true. It will probably be the single, like, most impactful experience I've ever had in my life. And I still keep in touch with those guys. And I was down right before the pandemic to a 50th birthday party in, you know, in North Houston, one of my guys. And what I thought was beautiful was that, you know, this predominantly or historically African-American neighborhood in North Houston, nobody thought it was weird that there was this white guy there drinking beer and eating boudin sausage and laughing and having a good time, because, you know, I was like them because of our, you know, military and Marine Corps experience. And so that's a really wonderful gift. And I have to say that, you know, if you can get out of the military without having, you know, a whole bunch of disabilities, like I have sleep apnea, some crazy hearing loss and ulcerative colitis, it gives you a great gift. And that happens, you know, that's, you can't, yeah, it's amazing. So, yeah.
Two questions together. Has writing about your experiences and also about the teenage years as well, it goes back and forth kind of, and people who have PTSD writing about their experiences, do you feel that that helps? Do you feel that brings things either to closure or to healing?
Absolutely. I actually the best teacher that I've ever had in my many years on this planet was a guy here in Los Angeles, Jim Caruso, who is a bit of a legend here in Los Angeles. And he would always say, you don't have to be happy. You just have to write. And I think that was really a great bit of advice because, you know, happiness, I think, is really overrated. And I think Americans are oddly obsessed with happiness, particularly middle-class Americans, you know, having to present like a smile for the world. And I would imagine, too, in a place like, you know, Minnesota, where there's that Minnesota nice. I don't know if it's true or not. All the Minnesotans I know are very nice. But it becomes a kind of burden in a way. So to your point about, you know, does this help ease PTSD or, you know, trauma? Yes, absolutely. For me, you know, again, people look at me, I'm the ultimate insider. If you look at me from the outside, I mean, I'm the center of what traditional like American society looks like. I'm a middle-aged heterosexual white male who's married. I have two kids. You know, I was, again, the football captain. I went to the Naval Academy, a Marine officer. But, you know, I've always sort of felt like I was swimming upstream all the time. And so there, you know, I've had trauma as well, and trauma related to these, you know, again, these sort of archetypical American male roles that I've played. And it's helped me let go of a lot of it and make peace with, you know, a lot of how I was brought up and the experiences that I had and, you know, in these different, very unforgiving, all, you know, dare I say, like bullying arenas. So, yeah, I think it's super helpful. And I would highly recommend to anybody out there who's thinking about writing, who has trauma, to do it. And you don't need, you know, you don't need anybody's permission. One of my big passions is demythologizing the process of storytelling. I don't have an MFA. Like I said, Jim Caruso's writing class was the only class that I ever took. I just sat down and I started writing. I read a lot. You know, I would recommend that you read, you write, and you be patient, but you absolutely have the right and are qualified to tell your story. You know, we look at places like whatever, it's NYU or Columbia or, you know, or University of Iowa, and their, you know, their writer's workshop. And, you know, I'm kind of in awe of it too. And there's a part of me that feels like, ooh, maybe I'm not a real writer because I don't have an MFA. It doesn't matter. If you can tell your story and you're passionate enough about it, you're qualified to do it. And I think, you know, I was a visiting writer for a week this past May at CUNY Kingsborough, which is the City University of New York at Kingsborough, which is at the far southeast end of Brooklyn. And as you would imagine, the diversity at CUNY Kingsborough was off the charts. And it was amazing because it reminded me in a lot of ways of the Marine Corps. And these classes that I spoke with, you know, I would say that a lot of these kids or these people thought they didn't have anything to say or whether their stories were worth telling, you know, but in those groups, you had people who had escaped civil wars in Yemen, who came here by raft or who walked here, you know, who then moved to neighborhoods filled with other people just like them who had had similar experiences and are taking care of siblings. Well, you know, and they just sort of think like, well, big deal. Like, I'm not special. And my message, I hope, was that, like, you know, you possess the story of humanity just in your life, even at age 18 or 19, and you absolutely have a right and are qualified to tell your story because we need to hear those stories.
Great. Brian, we have run out of time. We have been speaking with Brian O'Hare, author of the short story collection, Surrender. Thanks so much. It's been a wonderful interview. We really appreciate your time here on a Tuesday night.
Thank you so much, Liz. I appreciate you having me.
You bet. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
And now this.
I do. I'm going to actually just go ahead and start from the beginning. And just before I begin reading, so listeners know, my book is told in two parts. There's the main narrative, and there's also an intercalary story. So I'm going to read a little bit of both for this first passage. His mind wanders back 6 months to a fetid basement, windowless, lit by a solitary bulb, empty except for sweaty bodies, meeting in sanctuary. There was arguing, then a loosely drawn plan, and a call for volunteers. They laughed when he raised his hand. Someone said, "Can't send a boy to do a man's job." Chapter 1. Destiny sucks. Sure, it can be all heart-bursting and undeniable and Bollywood dance numbers and meet me at the Empire State Building, except when someone else wants to decide who I'm going to sleep with for the rest of my life. Then destiny is a bloodsucker and not the swoony, sparkly vampire kind. The night is beautiful. Clear and bright with silvery stars, but I'm walking across a noxious parking lot with my parents toward a wedding where a well-meaning auntie will certainly pinch my cheeks like I'm 2 years old, and a kindly uncle will corner me about my college plans with the inevitable question, pre-med or pre-law? In other words, it's time for me to wear a beauty pageant smile while keeping a very stiff upper lip. It would be helpful if I could grow a thicker skin too, armor perhaps, but we're almost at the door. My purse vibrates. I dig around for my phone. A text from Violet. "You should be here." Another buzz, and a picture of Violet appears, decorated in streamers, dancing in the gym, jeans skinny, lips glossed. Everyone is at Morp without me. It's bad enough I can't go to the actual prom, but missing Morp, too, is death by paper cuts. Morp is the informal prom send-up where everyone goes stag and dances their faces off, and there are always new couples emerging from the dark corners of the gym. I miss all the drama, as usual. "Maya, what's wrong?" My mother eyes me with suspicion, as always. I only wish I could muster up the courage to actually warrant any of her distrust. "Nothing," I sigh. "Then why do you look like you're going to a funeral instead of your friend's wedding?" I widen my toothy fake smile. "Better? Maybe I should give my mom what she wants tonight, the dutiful daughter who's thrilled to wear gold jewelry and high heels and wants to be a doctor. But the high heels alone are so uncomfortable, I can only imagine how painful the rest of the act would be. I guess a little happiness is too much to ask of my only daughter." Dad's chuckling, head down. At least someone is amused by my mother's melodrama. We step through an arc of red carnations and orange-yellow marigolds to a blur of jewel-toned silk saris and sparkly fairy lights strung in lazy zigzags across the wall. The Bollywood-eyed suburban wedding hall feels pretty cinematic, yet the thought of the awkward social situations to come makes me turn back and look longingly at the doors. But there is no escape. The tinkling of her silver-belled anklets signal the not-to-be-missed approach of Yasmin, who addresses my mother with the honorific auntie, the title accorded all mom-aged Indian women, relation or not. "Assalamu alaikum, Sophia auntie." Yasmin is only 2 years older than me. In my mom's eyes, we should be BFFs. Our parents have known each other since their old Hyderabad days, and my mom has been trying to make a friendship happen since Yasmin's family moved to the States several years ago. But in real life, we're a dud of a match. Also, she's an annoying butt-kisser. But the girl's got style. Yasmin is dressed to snare the attention of a suitable young gentleman, preferably more than one, because a girl needs options. Her peacock-colored lehenga that sweeps the floor, her arms full of sparkling bangles, her emerald and pearl choker, and the killer kajal that lines her eyelids make her the perfect candy-colored Bollywood poster girl. "Asif, uncle, how are you? Mommy will be so excited to see you both." "Maya, Aziz, look at you. You're adorable. That shade of pink really suits you. You should wear Indian clothes more often, you know." I don't even try to hide it when I roll my eyes. You've seen me wear Indian clothes a million times. Come on, Aisha's getting ready in the bridal room. My mom winks her blessing at Yasmin. Dekh kar beta, and show her how to be at least a little Indian. So much for family solidarity. Yasmin wraps my wrist in a death grip and drags me through the lobby to the tune of Ek Ladki Ko Dekha, an old Bollywood love song that inspired millions of tears. Everyone seems happy to be here, except me.
That was Samira Ahmed reading from New York Times bestseller Love, Hate, and Other Filters. Welcome, Samira.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you read the beginning that leads into chapter one.
Yes.
Is there anything you want to say about how you chose the formatting and the layout?
Sure. So as I mentioned, you know, there's two narratives. There's the main story of Maya's story, you know, the story of this young Indian American Muslim girl going through high school. And, you know, she's like a girl like all the other girls. She has dreams and crushes, you know, hopes, ambitions. She wants to be a filmmaker. She has trying to meet her parents' expectations, but also live her own life. And then there's also an intercalary story that follows an act of domestic terrorism,
right,
as it's about to occur. And in the book, those two stories meet each other. So there's eventually kind of a literal and metaphorical explosion. But that intercalary story was actually inspired by two, you know, very specific things. One is the intercalary chapters in The Grapes of Wrath.
Okay.
Which I really loved. And, you know, initially when I read The Grapes of Wrath, I was kind of like, wow, why is there this whole, like, two-paragraph, you know, intrusion in the main narrative where he's just describing a turtle crossing the road who gets a pebble stuck in its shell.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, I realized how these intercalary chapters give you these great inroads to the main narrative of the Jodes.
Right.
And then the second feeling, which was trying to capture more of a tone or the tension I tried to build in the intercalary chapters, was inspired by a line from Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Oh, okay.
Which we know about the Clutter murders. And, you know, it's nonfiction, so we know what the ending is going to be. But he has a line in there where he says, "Presently the car crept forward." And that line in his book really jumped out at me because I had such a reaction to that. Like, no, you know, I don't want that car to creep forward. I want something to happen. I know what's going to happen, but I want, you know, I want the action to change. I want, you know, the engine to fail. I want the carburetor to fall out. I want something else to happen that prevents that car from going forward because I know what the next thing is going to
right.
be. So just in those few words, he built such tension. And I just love the tone that he was able to use. And, you know, I just was really gripped by that really simple sentence.
Yeah, I see what you mean. That sort of tension of the audience knowing what's happening, but unable to stop it.
Right.
So the character that you are introducing, Ethan, we see sort of clips of memories and things that don't necessarily add together to equal something to the reader until we get further along. Yeah, it was very mysterious. So I thought, and one thing I noticed about that was that, so he is a white supremacist, but he wasn't overly simplified into like just an evil force or something that's blatantly evil immediately. It was quite sophisticated.
Right. Well, I'm going to just pause for a second because there's like major spoilers in there. So I don't want to, I'm trying not to speak too much to that specific piece in there. You know, Maya also in her main narrative encounters Islamophobia from
Brian,
you know, a kid in her class who is, you know, extremely hateful and, you know, might also be somehow wrapped up in potentially sort of his early initiation into white supremacy. I mean, not in necessarily a formal way like joining an organization, but, you know, the tentacles are reaching out to him. So there is that element in the book.
Right.
But I try to care, you know, I try to, you know, really flesh out the characters. I mean, I don't want sort of some kind of stereotypical cartoony bad guy.
Right.
You know, whether, you know, every person in the book is supposed to be like a real person, you know, the thing about people who commit acts of terrorism, you know, who commit horrible hate crimes. You know, they're people too. They may be monsters, but that in a way, like, to me, feels more terrifying, that the monster is someone that we know, that we have perhaps, you know, grown up next to, or is in our class, or, you know, that is on the bus with us.
Right.
So I want to, you know, create like a, you know, well fleshed out character.
Did you think about the causes of Islamophobia when you were writing those characters?
The causes of Islamophobia? I mean, I honestly don't think there's a cause per se for, you know, prejudice or, you know, bigotry, hatred. You know, a lot of it stems from ignorance, but I don't think of it as having like one inciting incident. I think, you know, fear and not understanding our common humanity is a large part of what contributes to hate. I mean, I talked about that ignorance, and, you know, I don't think I can speak to the mind of someone who is a bigot as to why they feel that way. But I try to capture, you know, a disaffected person who might, you know, who might lean in that direction. It doesn't necessarily mean that every person who feels sort of disaffected or disenfranchised in some way is going to become, you know, a bully or a Islamophobe or, you know, commit a hate crime or whatever. But, you know, like I said, I was trying to create a real person,
right?
Real people. And people have passed. And they have things that happen to them. I don't necessarily think there's, you know, one-to-one correlation in an incident in our past that makes us a certain way. But, you know, the sum of our experiences do help make us who we are.
I guess I was excited in reading one of your characters who seemed to be struggling with some identity issues. But I won't say more since you don't want to give away where the story leads. So how did you decide that this was a novel you wanted to write?
Well, my story came to me, it wasn't, you know, like I was just talking about how, you know, I don't really think that things are incited by a single incident, but there were a few incidents that sort of came together in my mind that led me to Maya's story. And one was just related to my own experiences of Islamophobia, experiencing it, you know, really for the first time when I was a child during the Iran hostage crisis, when an adult man, you know, looked at me. I was a really little kid. He looked at me, he just with this really, just like this mask of like hatred on his face, and pointed at me and said a string of words, which I'm not allowed to say on the radio, and ended it with, "Go home, you blank, blank, blank Iranian." And I was utterly shocked by this. I'd never heard words like that before, and certainly not directed towards me. And I was also just shocked by the fact of his ignorance. Like, why, how could this racist be so bad at geography? Like, I'm Indian, I'm not Iranian. Why would he tell me to go home? Like, my home is like, you know, half an hour away from here. Is that what he means? You know, a kid tries to rationalize things like that. And that incident is something that stayed with me. I mean, it's really etched in my brain. And, you know, I think anyone who experiences something like that, you know, it's something that you just cannot forget. And then after 9/11, there were two particular things that happened, not to me, but I was living in New York City during 9/11 and then the years after. And one of my friends, I remember seeing her in the weeks after 9/11, and she was really stricken because, you know, the man that she buys her newspaper from, the newspaper kiosk guy, you know, in New York City, in Manhattan, on a lot of the corners, there's, you know, the kiosk that sells you newspapers, magazines, they can be in the subway, wherever. Well, the man who sold her the newspapers was Sikh, and she saw him, and he had been beaten up.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he had a bruised and battered face, and it was because some people beat him up because they thought he was Muslim. He was wearing a turban, you know, he's Sikh. And then after that, sometime later, there was another incident in New York City where a cab driver was assaulted, stabbed by the passenger because the passenger saw his name, you know, on his cabbie license and had asked the man, "Are you Muslim?" And, you know, this enraged him enough to, like, assault his driver. And I don't know, something about reading that last one and kind of really brought up some of those memories from of me, you know, of mine when I was a kid, especially because there was, you know, there was a big spike in Islamophobia or, you know, hate crimes after 9/11. And I don't know, that combination of stories kind of led me into Maya story, because I really wanted to capture this moment of childhood when, you know, something in your worldview or your life is utterly shattered. Even though you have literally nothing to do with it. You're not expecting it. You know, you're just going through your day, and because of what you look like or the sound of your name or the color of your skin, it's something so hateful happens to you. And just, you know, like I said, it's like that moment when something inside of you is shattered. And I wanted to try to capture that.
Do you have another passage prepared to read to us?
I do. Yes.
Will you go ahead
and read it? Yes, it's the same thing. It's going to be a little bit of an intercalary chapter and then a couple paragraphs of Maya's story. She wakes before dawn to say her first prayer. She's always loved the ritual, starting off the day with a devotion to God, sitting on the prayer rug with her legs curled beneath her as a thread of dawn appears against the horizon. This is the moment when she feels most at peace, before she makes breakfast for her husband, before they drive together to their small grocery store, before the shop fills with a cacophony of women searching for fava beans, cumin, apricots, dried lentils, rose water, pistachios, cardamom, pickled eggplants, and vinegar. Even after many years in this country, some still try to haggle as if they're in the bazaar back home. She pushes the complaints from her mind. In a few days, she will be the one preparing the feast. Kamal comes home, and there'll be reason to celebrate. She will drive the entire way, 7 hours from Springfield to Dearborn. She worries the drive will be too tiring for him, that he will eat too much fast food on the way and not be hungry for dinner. "Ma, I'm always hungry for your cooking," he assures her. More and more, he sounds like an American, but at least he knows how to show his mother proper respect. Chapter 9. Friday, the last day of break, my last day with Phil before school starts again on Monday, when we return to the respective corners of our social cliques. Soon enough, these lovely last days of swimming in cool water under a bright blue sky will fade from our memories like a pastel drawing left in the sun. But today is perfect. Bill runs into the pond ahead of me. I step forward, my usual hesitation giving way to a tiny spark of confidence. I secure my goggles, check the waterproof bandage on my leg, and swim 6 remarkably even strokes to reach Bill. Swimming, me, in water. I'm not exactly giving Katie Ledecky a run for her money. Still, I did a thing I was scared to do, but there's no way I could have done it without Phil. "You're swimming for real." He's standing in the water, arms crossed, beaming at me as I come up. "It was only a few strokes. In the next couple hours, you'll be swimming laps, thanks to you. It's the only thing I could teach you. You're better than me at everything else. You're forgetting wilderness first aid and avoiding bear attacks." I almost add, "and football," but decide against it. Both are way more practical than dissecting literary symbolism. "Probably not in New York City." Phil turns to swim the length of the pond. I follow him in and try to remember to move my arms and legs in harmony with my breath, slow but steady. I swallow a few mouthfuls of water and lose count of my strokes and mess up my breathing, but I don't panic. I right myself. When I start shivering, I step out of the water, grab my towel, and sit on our beach so I can warm up in the sun. I film Phil as he swims, capturing his grace, how his smooth strokes barely ripple the surface. I need to cinematize this, all of this. I'll want proof later. I'll need to know that this isn't all the land of make-believe.
That was Samir Ahmed reading from her debut novel, Love, Hate, and Other Filters. So the fact that Maya wants to be a filmmaker plays into the novel in a couple different interesting ways. How did you develop that part of her characterization?
Well, I wanted Maya to have a passion, and you know, filmmaking to me seemed like a really natural fit. I guess she sort of came to me as an aspiring filmmaker. And Maya uses her camera both as the way she sees the world, the way she shapes it, the way she really edits her own life in a way, you know, the way she curates the things that she wants to see and remember. And at the same time, the camera is a filter for her, you know, it separates her from the action, from, you know, the world outside of or beyond her lens. And she, you know, in growing into herself and trying to figure out what her journey beyond school is going to be, has to see if she can step out from behind the camera and kind of become, you know, the leading lady in her own story. So it really serves kind of this dual purpose, both as kind of this filter of the way she views the world, and also something that separates her.
Right. It also created some tension with her parents.
Yes, because her parents do not want her to be a filmmaker. They look at it really as only a hobby, even though her father is the one who first got her, got her first camcorder so she could record a family wedding in India. And, you know, her parents want something that's more practical for her, something that's more stable. They really would love her to become, you know, a doctor or a lawyer, but she doesn't like the sight of blood, so doctor is really out for her. But I think that her parents, you know, like all immigrants who choose to come to America, are literally, you know, destabilizing themselves from their home country. In this case, it's India, and they're trying to reroute themselves in a new land. They're trying to create that stability, and they want the same thing for their daughter. You know, they want to provide their child with, you know, like all parents do, with, you know, like that sort of even floor, the stability to like have a successful life. And they want that for Maya. They want her to have financial security. And to them, the idea of the arts seems like, you know, how are you going to pay, you know, your rent and your health insurance? And, you know, what if you don't get a job? And what if it takes years? And, you know, what will you do if it doesn't work out? It doesn't seem like a practical thing for them to do. But Maya wants to try to follow her passion. And she has to figure out, like, can I, you know, be the good, loving daughter I want to be, but still try to pursue the life that I want for myself that seems at odds with the life that my parents think I should have.
Do you think some of those tensions are inside of Maya because she has two cultures, both Indian and American?
Yeah, I mean, I think Maya definitely, you know, has a foot in both worlds. And, you know, it's that double consciousness that W.B. Du Bois talked about. It's not really anything new. Like, so many people in America have that, where they have to, you know, code switch, whether it's from their home life or their school life or work and, you know, something else. And Maya has to do that too. You know, Maya loves her parents and she loves her culture. And Maya herself doesn't feel like, you know, her culture is at odds with her desire to be a filmmaker, you know. Like, India has a obviously giant film industry. I mean, Bollywood is, you know, this booming industry, and obviously there are Indian filmmakers, but her parents' sort of desire for her to have that security and that stability is the thing that is really kind of getting in her way. That's not to them, they, you know, they are fearful of this. It's kind of unknown to them. And for Maya, you know, she can understand a part of it, and yet at the same time, she's struggling with how to reconcile that with what she wants. Like, either she can go along with what her parents say and probably be not happy, or she can try to do what she wants, but, you know, and make her parents unhappy and thereby still make herself kind of unhappy. So, you know, it's a real struggle for her. So I think something that teenagers are probably pretty familiar with, whether their parents come from a different sort of cultural background than the one they're growing up in or not. It's just the idea of, you know, that natural tension between parents and children as kids are growing up and growing away and more independent from their parents. And yet their parents might be still trying to, you know, hold on a little bit. And perhaps those parents have expectations that don't really align with what the child wants.
Well, we're almost out of time. Thank you so much for coming on their show tonight. Do you want to say anything about what's next for you?
Sure. I have. I actually have two books coming out in 2019. The first book, which is going to be spring 2019, is called Internment, and it's a near future speculative novel that follows a young woman and her family as they are amongst the first Muslims who are forced into internment camps.
Okay.
And this young woman is, you know, trying to find the courage to both fight against that, to fight against, you know, overt fascism and bigotry, and also against, you know, the insidious silent complicity all around her. And then I have another novel coming out later in 2019 called Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know. And that is actually a literary mystery The main character is a young woman whose parents are Indian American and French, and on their annual summer trip to Paris, this young woman meets the six times great grandson of Alexandre Dumas. And the two of them find a reference in a letter between the painter Delacroix and the writer Dumas to a 19th century Muslim woman. And they sat off on kind of the trail to figure out who is this woman that's appearing in these letters between Delacroix and Dumas. And there's like a second narrative, sort of like in Love, Hate, and Other Filters, where we actually see the story of that woman as they are trying to find her.
Well, sounds intriguing. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I'm having fun with it.
We'll look forward to reading it when it comes out.
Thank you so much.
Have a good night.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
And now this.
You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Sam. I'd like to thank our guest tonight, Brian O'Hare, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. You can listen to all your favorite Right On Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you stream your podcasts. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota. ¶¶